If you follow the world of research in depression, addiction, creativity, or neural connectivity patterns, well, you might heard of the new old kid on the block, and that is psilocybin, the psychedelic drug that has been around for thousands of years but shunned after the hippie movement. Recently, though, it has been found to be a relatively safer and non-toxic intervention to help those with long-term depression or to reduce addiction behaviors due to its ability to bypass normal neural connections and create novel connections in the brain. It's a really fascinating new area of study that I think we're going to hear a lot more about as it becomes better understood and more widely adopted. On the show today, I have Gabrielle Karalimbides, the founder of Odyssey, whose name I may or may not have said correctly. Odyssey is the first psilocybin retreat opening in Oregon, America, offering legal retreats and individual psilocybin experiences to people in a controlled setting. We discuss where the science of psychedelics and psilocybin is in terms of its impact and who it is and isn't for, and what are its limitations. We go into the science of what is going on in the different parts of the brain and how a loss of ego comes about, as well as things like who guide you on a psilocybin experience and how do they become a registered guide in the first place. Besides the fact that I found the whole thing very interesting, I also loved that Gabriel wasn't trying to push psilocybin as a cure-all, and he was very open-minded on its limitations and where the science doesn't yet have answers. And so it was a really comprehensive deep dive into what we currently know and what we are still working on, and I think it will give you a solid understanding of what happens during a guided experience. So hello and welcome to the Growth Mindset podcast with me, Sam Webster-Harris, and I hope you enjoy this episode, and I hope you enjoy the interview. The Cozy Earth Mother's Day sale is here. Their incredible bedding and loungewear is mind-blowingly satisfying to touch, and it is sourced from bamboo, and it's good for the planet, free from toxins, it gets softer with every single wash, and it's naturally temperature regulating. My mum approves, and yours will too. Listeners get 35% off any order at cozyearth.com using code GROWTH.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
I do like to ask at the start, how do people define growth mindset for themselves? I was also reading about some of the studies that you sent me, and they talk about oceanic boundlessness as a scale. And I was wondering how you define oceanic boundlessness, and if there is any cross between the two of growth mindset and oceanic boundlessness.
Cool, I like it. All right, so taking that in order. So growth mindset, I would define it, at least for myself, is just this attitude that you can always do better, that you can always grow, that very few things are truly fixed and finite, and that you have this attitude that barriers are challenges and things that you can overcome rather than insurmountable objects. And that's very healthy. And just going through life, knowing that, let me continuously try to do better and know that I can do better. And that oftentimes effort and persistence matter way more than innate ability or something else. Then that's kind of, yeah, embracing a growth mindset. And oceanic boundlessness, I'll be interested to hear me try to combine these two. I haven't thought about their analogy before, but oceanic boundlessness, there's, in a lot of these psychedelic studies, people have what I refer to as mystical type experiences, mystical experiences. And then the research community has been trying to figure out how to measure a mystical experience, because they have found that people who have these mystical experiences tend to experience enduring change in some capacity. And so there's a number of different elements of a mystical experience. One of those is oceanic boundlessness, which I love. It's a research question, research scale. But it's really the sense that the universe is vast and that there isn't this separation necessarily between yourself and the world and the universe. And so a lot of people have this sense that they're ego or their sense of self can kind of dissolve and then become one with this very, very expansive existence. It gets a little out there, and I think anything related to spirituality can be hard to put into words or to define, but oceanic boundlessness is, yeah, related to this unity and expansiveness with everything around them and with the universe. And yeah, let's see. Okay, let's try to compare growth mindset and oceanic boundlessness. You know, in some sense, my first sense is that I can think of them as quite different in a sense. Like, I do think that having this unifying experience can be enormously beneficial for folks. So in some sense, it can lead to a lot of growth and kind of the way you view yourself, and that changes just the way you interact with other people. So I do think it's a very strong growth tool. But on the other hand, I think growth mindset is in some sense fairly self-oriented, which is, you know, what are the ways that I can do better, or I can overcome this thing, or in some sense, the ego feels more involved and it's about how can I be better? And oceanic boundlessness is almost the opposite, which is, oh, the ego disappears and separates and you're just kind of one with everything.
I actually quite like that I asked that question. I felt like I intuitively understood oceanic boundlessness, but then the way you explained it colored it in way more detail down a direction I probably wouldn't have gone quite so far in. I was definitely feeling ideas of like limitlessness or just possibility, which you could associate a bit more with growth mindset in some ways. So it was good to hear that it's more ephemeral loss of self. So thank you for answering a hard question. That was fascinating. And I also was reading about anxious ego dissolution, which I thought sounded interesting, and I probably would also mess up if I tried to explain it. But could you explain more about that and how it comes around?
It's not too dissimilar from oceanic boundlessness, and that it's still tied to the same idea, which is, oh, okay, during these experiences, many people have this feeling that their ego dissolves, and that these normal self-referential processes, what am I going to do in the future, worrying, ruminating about the past, really just any thoughts about the self kind of dissolve. And you no longer can fully identify what is me and what is the world, where is the separation, and it's really just experience. And that can be either really beautiful or really scary or both. And so sometimes if you don't have a sense of self and you don't have a strong ego, that can feel destabilizing. That can feel like, well, then what room do I have to stand on? And so people can experience anxiety going into that. And then often that then becomes this like really beautiful experience where people feel a lot of love and a lot of unity, and they're not so worried that the fact that they don't feel like a separate self anymore. But it's often accompanied by anxiety, especially on the onset.
Do you think there's any pairing between the two in terms of psychologists often try to pair anxiety with excitement for people who are trying to give a speech or something? Is there anything like that, do you think, going on?
I mean, it's certainly the same force, yeah. And I very much agree that there are oftentimes there's some energy, and that can be interpreted in multiple ways. That can either be interpreted as, yeah, I'm about to give a speech and my heart starts racing, and that's either nervousness or excitement, depending on how kind of you interpret it. The sensation is this dissolving, which again is quite hard to articulate exactly what that feels like. Ineffability, like the inability to describe this, is another key part of the mystical experience. So all of this is going to sound a little esoteric, but yeah, I mean, that's the core sensation. If you, that's the core feeling, and that can either be very scary or it can be very peaceful and beautiful. So for sure, it does come down to like, okay, what is the lens through which you're interpreting this? What is your general attachment for things to be a certain way?
Why do you think we are so attached to our ego, and yet there is an ability for us to experience the loss of it using things like psilocybin? It just seems sort of strange that we couldn't just have less of it in the first place, or that we need a tool to help us be unlocked from it.
My foray into this is, I'm not a very religious or spiritual person, but I found like Buddhism and Buddhist philosophy and psychology to be very fascinating, and I think very, very true for at least my own experience. At the core of that is, hey, we suffer because we have desires, because we are attached to things, because the root of suffering is self-centered craving, right? So inherently, it's the Buddha saying, listen, this happens to all humans. And we suffer because we do have this ego, and this ego wants things to be a certain way. So on one lens, it's like, okay, let me just turn off that switch and everything will be peaceful. But it unfortunately doesn't seem to be that easy. So I think it just touches into the same thing that, you know, like I think a lot of us have intuitions for how we want to live or how we want to feel, or if only we could feel X, if only we could do Y, then we would feel a certain way. But it just seems very challenging. It's not a switch that we can just flip. And it's something that we have to continually try to grow and cultivate and work on. And for many people, that's a very kind of spiritual growth path, you know, personal growth, spiritual growth. But I think it's kind of classic. There's probably an evolutionary reason why we have it, where if we didn't have this drive to get things, to acquire things, that we might not search for food, that we might not do the survival skills necessary to live. But it doesn't mean that it's ideal for psychological well-being.
Mm. Yeah, we're full of evolutionary relics that aren't that suitable for the world we live in today. I also wouldn't call myself religious, but I've done like the 10-day Vipassana and basically subscribe to most of the Buddhist answers to things. It just seems to be very sensible. And like half of the podcast, you could say it is a Buddhism podcast if you actually dug beneath it. Also, Stoicism, I feel, has a lot of crossovers as well, which is nice. And I guess maybe people on your retreats would be learning some more Buddhist or Stoic outlooks on life through it.
Totally. We find this very curious link between these worlds. And for me, Stoicism and Buddhism, one, they have, I think, a lot more in common than they do different. And there's just something about these ancient philosophies that I think they did see something very true about the human condition. And I think that modern psychology is in many ways catching up to these, and that all of the new wave cognitive behavioral therapies seem to be very, very influenced by mindfulness practices or by non-attachment and all sorts of things. And there does seem to be this very curious link between psychedelic experiences and these ancient philosophies and meditation. And oftentimes one leads to the other, where someone will take a psychedelic and suddenly become very curious about the human mind or about their experience. And they then have this intuition that they should be meditating more, and the two pair very nicely together.
That's nice. Do you have a recommended reading list out of interest for participants?
Yeah, you know, it's probably too long. I could consolidate it top of the read How to Change Your Mind or watch How to Change Your Mind. If I had to choose one, that's it. But then there's like a handful of other like adjacent reads, depending on what you're interested in. Michael Singer has a couple of really great books that have nothing to do with psychedelics, but I think are very, very similar to this. Let me take that as an action item, and I can come up with five that I would recommend.
Yeah, if you send them to me, I can read them out at the end of the podcast. I have a few ideas myself for you. So if you've ever watched a cheesy TV show where the two main characters are clearly head over heels for each other, and they quite frankly just need to get a room and do the thing so they can finally have a sensible conversation afterwards. Well, it turns out that Gabriel and I are both quite unerrably excited about books, and we really needed to have a frantically passionate 20-minute conversation about books before we were able to get it together and resume normal podcast interview responsibilities. I have chosen to leave that out of the episode, but fellow book lovers, rest assured that I will give you the highlight of Gabe's, yes, he's a Gabe to me now, the highlight of his book recommendations at the end of the episode. Back to ego disillusionment and trying to explain the feeling and why it's strange. In the instruction FAQs, you have a section saying, if you see a door, walk through it. If you feel like you're dying, melting, dissolving, exploding, going crazy, etc., go ahead, embrace it. And it can be helpful to float downstream instead of clinging to metaphorical banks of the river, allowing the current to take you wherever it's headed. That feels like a lot of embracing what's going on in your actual journey as you take psilocybin, but then is that a lesson that people then take forwards in life? Could you unpack some of why you've written these statements and how it helps people?
Part of the reason why these services are important and helpful is that these experiences can be scary and they can be overwhelming. And if you're not expecting it and you don't feel kind of equipped to manage what's going on, it can do more harm than good. And there are a handful of tools. You know, we like to think about this, and you know, kind of the whole community likes to think about these as journeys, which I think is quite a good analogy, and that you really are embarking on something, and that it's filled with deep emotions and challenges and beauty and all sorts of things. And it's helpful to have like a handful of tools in your toolkit as you embark on this journey. And part of that is like knowing what is the right mindset to cultivate before and but especially during an experience. And that attitude is exactly these, which is you want to cultivate a similar mindset as you would if you were sitting on a cushion meditating, which is kind of maintain a bit of, let me observe what's going on. Let me not overly react. Let me have an attitude of curiosity. Let me relinquish control. Let me not try to control things or for want things to be a certain way. Let me let go of expectations. Let me just be radically present and curious about what's going on. And, you know, a lot of times people have monsters appear or some kind of challenging thing. And sometimes that can represent something in the psyche that needs to be addressed. And so rather than tighten up and run away and shirk away from things, we encourage people to like, hey, connect to your body, connect to your breath, relax, observe, bring curiosity, and go towards challenges. Because that oftentimes what might start as a monster or something very dark turns into something very beautiful and light. And that's where a lot of the growth lies. And so these are essential tools that I'm sure not only are helpful during a psychedelic experience, but beyond too, our prerogative is to make sure that folks are equipped, especially during the experience.
How easy is it to understand what's going on with people in terms of like the communication? Can they just be like, oh, I'm trying to walk through this door? What level, are they taking like the hero dose or are they kind of like slightly half in reality? And how can they communicate these things and how do you help them as a guide during the experience?
There's a number of facets to it. The first one is, what is the guide's experience? What is it like? Like, how does a guide know what's going on? And sometimes it's obvious. I think what's more obvious is physiologically what's going on. Sometimes people look like they're asleep and you really have no idea. You don't know if they're sleeping or if they are really in some other world entirely. You very rarely are they actually sleeping. Almost certainly they're going through something fairly intense. Sometimes it can be more mild, but some of the time you have absolutely no idea. And most of the journey is spent with eye shades on and you're listening to music. And as a guide, you're just there to provide a lot of being a great guide and an organization is to create all the conditions before the experience, up to the experience, so that the person feels totally safe and comfortable. And then you really act as more of a facilitation type role rather than steering their experience. So in the moments, they might be just laying there, not doing too much. Sometimes it's pretty obvious, not necessarily what the contents of their experience are, but that they're going through something intense. Their hearts can start beat quite fast, you know, over 120 beats per minute just sitting there. And so like oftentimes that's accompanied with anxiety. That means they're going through something. So yeah, we have no idea if they're facing a monster or if they're just generally freaking out or what it is, but oftentimes that there's a palpable noticing of anxiety. Sometimes there's a massive smile on their face. And so again, the contents are unclear that they're like experiencing love and boundlessness and going through something like a fairly ecstatic. And then some of the time people do get overwhelmed and they need to take off their blindfolds and then interact with us or with the guides. And then those are the moments that like being a great guide is really important to help someone calm down. Again, we really don't steer people's experiences too much. We just let them know that they're safe. We're here. Say the right words at the right time to make someone feel calm and safe again, and then go back down on the mats, put on nightshades, and go back into the journey. This experience is not meant to be talked through, and there's a risk of, you know, you might diminish what you get out of the experience if you spend too much time talking to someone, writing things down. It really is like you're rowing in a boat, you're going along for a ride.
And I was going to also ask is, do you people ever write down what they're going through or not? Because certainly if you do the Dente Vipassana retreat, for example, you're not allowed any kind of stimulation, like things to read or a pen to write on or anything. It's just you and your mind.
So actually, we do let folks write down some during the experience. I'm curious what your experience was at the Vipassana Center, not being able to write things down, how that was for you, if you're grateful for that or if not. But yeah, for us, we do let, it can be very helpful to write down two words. Something to capture something that they're going through, because that can then be an anchor that can jog a whole series of memories. So we do let folks write some down, but really do encourage folks to not spend too much time in that, and that can really detract from it. And then certainly the following day, even that evening, a fair amount of writing happens, which is, hey, you have a lot of fresh memories. You have a lot of raw data. Some amount of that your body has already internalized. But that some of that is like really helpful to have to take into the integration period, the post-processing period, which is, oh, this, I want to work through this, or I had this insight, or I had X, Y, and Z happen. And we do encourage folks to try to capture that while it's fresh.
To answer your question of how is it not writing for the 10-day retreat whilst you're obviously having lots of breakthroughs and things, I found like I got accepted it pretty easily and I actually remembered everything, which I was a bit surprised about. But basically afterwards, I just went and made a bunch of notes for like 3 days. It was strange every day because you don't have anything to read, but there is just like a little quote outside the dining hall each morning about something related to like what's going on that day. And it felt like I was having this crazy individual journey of doing different things. And then like each day the quote would somehow be relevant to kind of like the place where I was at in terms of kind of like day five or day six, who said something about like a burning man. And that was the day where I had like the weird, my entire body felt like it was burning on fire day. And I didn't even notice it until after I just had the session and I've just read the quote about like, oh, you'll have the burning fire man day. I was like, what? I thought I was being unique with my mental experience all by myself, which was kind of funny. But yeah, I definitely had a lot of memory through that. But the second time I did want to write more stuff down as I was going through it. And it's definitely a confusion in my own sort of just general meditation of letting yourself interrupt halfway through because you have so many different ideas that do kind of get lost if you don't record them versus is the meditation actually about letting go of like your constant striving to have ideas and be more at peace with yourself, opposing forces going on. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. And they want you to ask yourself, what is the first thing you would do if you had an extra hour in the day? Would you go for a run, take a nap, read a book? Many of us wish we had more time, which is something we've been talking about in this episode, but what for? The best way to squeeze that thing into your schedule is to know what's important for you and to prioritize it. Therapy can help you find what matters to you and do more of that thing. Personally, I found therapy with BetterHelp really did help me to stop running around like a nutter so much and make peace with some of the things I thought I wanted to do and do more of what I actually enjoy. If you're thinking of starting therapy, then BetterHelp is entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. So learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/growthmindset today to get 10% off your first month. That is betterhelp.com/growthmindset. In most cases, being a good boss means hiring talented people and then getting out of their way. LinkedIn Jobs is here to help small businesses hire quality candidates faster and for free. It isn't just a job board with over a billion users. No, you can find professionals that don't appear anywhere else. 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other hiring sites, and many of them might not even be actively searching for a role, yet could be open to a perfect opportunity. On LinkedIn, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours of posting their job. So hire professionals like a professional on LinkedIn. You can join 2.5 million other small businesses using LinkedIn to hire faster and for free by posting your job at linkedin.com/growth. That's linkedin.com/growth, GROWTH, to post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply. You mentioned the word processing, which we'll get to in a second. I just wanted to ask, because you also mentioned heartbeats, do you have any monitoring devices on participants during the process?
No, we encourage folks to not wear too much, because I think the more you add, the more you risk of taking away from the experience. So yeah, it would be fascinating to like, oh, let's look at everyone's heartbeat over the course of a journey. Will you actually learn something interesting from that? Probably not as much. I'm sure there's something interesting there across, you know, many people. But I think for an individual's experience, it's not worth it so much. So down the road, there's a pretty rich stream of inquiries, which is, yeah, hey, let's look at fMRI data before and after a session. What changed? Let's look at sleep architecture before and after. What changed? Let's look at heart rate variability. There is a lot of interesting work to be done there, maybe more in the research domain. For now, and maybe Odyssey is fairly new at this point, maybe 5 years down the road, we'll start incorporating some stuff like that. But right now we're focused on what we think is the most important and powerful aspects of the experience and just making sure those are super dialed in.
That makes sense. I mentioned that we're going to go into the concept of post-processing. What does post-processing involve on a retreat?
the question applies, which is just, hey, you just have this experience, 1X. And so there's no perfect answer here. It really depends on each individual, but like, there's a certain set of commonalities, which is generally speaking, and we touched on this a little bit before, while things are fresh, try to capture it. Try to capture everything you experience. Do a lot of writing, especially the next day. Do a lot of writing. Listen to the same playlist. Reconnect to the experience and see if you can start that process of, it's almost like going on a second journey the next day, just without the substance, where it is a little bit more lucid, of course, and it's a chance to really capture everything that happened, start the meaning-making process, which is kind of the next step, which is, okay, now we have the raw data. What does it mean? What does this mean to you? What are the insights that you had? What are the experiences that you felt? Was this a somatic experience? Did you have some psychological insights? Did you feel this profound ineffability with the universe? What was the experience that you had? And how does that make sense for your life? So this is like a lot of self-inquiry. It's a lot of writing. It's a lot of connecting the experience and thinking about, okay, this is what I felt. This is what I think it means. This is what I think I can do with the experience. Then for one person, it might mean, okay, now, you know, maybe I need to go talk to my mom or my father or my friend or something like that and repair a relationship, or I should start meditating more, or I should go to church more, or I should journal more. A lot of times people have some intuitive sense for how to incorporate their experience into their life, but it's so hard to give a one-size-fits-all answer. And then there's a certain set of wisdom that we share with folks, which is don't make any radical life changes within the first couple of weeks. You know, a lot of times people do this and they feel they have clarity into something, some big decision they should make. And that might be true. Maybe that this is exactly what they needed to see what that thing is. But wait a few days, wait a couple of weeks and see how you're feeling. Oftentimes people have this kind of afterglow period that can fade. And you need to make sure that whatever you felt that felt true still feels true after the afterglow period. So don't make any radical changes. And then we generally encourage folks, if they feel up for it, develop a bit of contemplative practice, whether it is meditation, journaling, slow walks, time in nature, things like that. So some things just seem to pair well with the psychedelic experience, and other things are super dependent on the individuals.
Yeah, obviously haven't been through a psychedelic retreat, but yeah, I've done like the 10-day Vipassana, and I've done like self-imposed, go somewhere quiet in nature and take like LSD without it being like a party setting or anything, definitely more of a deeply about life and stuff. And it's always led to some pretty big breakthroughs of pulls out some things that are inside you that you haven't quite reflected on in the right way or realized. One thing, the whole point of the retreats is to help people and to give them an afterwards that is better than the before. I think we have both read lots of science around this and know clearly that it's mostly a good thing. But could you dig into that a bit more for me in terms of like, what are the main benefits for someone and why would they be doing this?
So you're going to continue to get frustrated with me because I'm going to give you a lot of these. It depends. Although if you're a psychology guy, then you're probably comfortable with that, but it depends. The depends answers. People come for many different reasons. So there's, I can give you the menu or if there's part of the menu and then identify some commonalities and try to identify some commonalities. And just thinking about like recent clients, we have some folks who come, they have brain cancer and they're going to pass away in the coming years. And they have like distress, understandably existential distress over, facing their mortality. And psilocybin tends to be like very good at helping people address their mortality and come to terms with the fact that they're going to die. And a lot of times people, not all, but oftentimes people report that they don't fear death nearly as much as they did before. Or another one used to have breast cancer and no longer does, but still lived in daily fear of this recurrence, went through an experience and that daily fear just disappeared, which is just so beautiful that can happen. So one of them is this, generally speaking, around death, and it's hard to identify what's common here, but another person we had come through recently really struggled with OCD, like very much so. It's one of those challenges that people don't realize how much it can impact someone's experience and just how much both mental bandwidth and hours of the day that it can take away from someone engaging in obsessive type thinking and behaviors and needing to do things in a very particular way. Like we had someone say, if you suspend at least an hour every single day showering in a very particular order, and he often needed the help of his wife. And then after, and he did this for 10 plus years. And then after a session, for the first time ever, he took 2-minute shower, no problems. And then he's like, and I haven't looked back since. We're about 6 weeks after his journey. So a lot of the big question is, does this endure? What do we need to do to help this endure? But OCD is another big one. And then that kind of opens the door that a lot of people come because they are suffering from some form of mental illness, whether it's OCD, trauma, they have PTSD, or they had some traumatic incident happen oftentimes early in life that still feels like it's stuck in the body and they're looking for resolution from that. And that's driven their life in so many different ways. So trauma resolution is really common. A lot of folks just with general, some form of depression or anxiety that they're looking to help alleviate. And then there's a lot of folks, maybe they don't have a diagnosis, but they often have some sense of feeling stuck, where they've been in therapy for a while. There's some thought pattern, some belief, something that they feel is just not moving despite all the work that they're doing outside of this. So we like to make sure that this is part of a process for someone and they're not expecting this to just be a panacea. And rather, you can think of this as a tool that can really help the therapeutic process. So this can really help therapy become much more effective, in a sense, for folks who really do feel stuck. So getting over a sense of stuckness is quite common. And then another one is for folks who are at transition points in their life. They might be about to retire. They might be kind of between careers. At some point where it feels like, hey, I'm trying to figure out how to live this next chapter of my life. And I want to do so from a place of feeling really connected to myself, really in touch with my values and what I care about. And these experiences can be perfect for that time, where it really does help connect people to themselves and clarify what matters to them. And they develop some insight for what should they do with this next chapter of their life.
I've had quite a few people recently around the topic of near-death experiences. And I do feel most people think they have a growth mindset, but then if they do get run over by a bus or something, they will go and change their life with a much more growth mindset attitude. And they might then look back at their life and think they were being a bit mediocre and not as ambitious as they could have been. Do you think as many people that maybe feel that they could be doing more, they just kind of, and because I feel like I would go just for the self-interest. That's a whole group of people.
Okay, I'm going to take your first question, then we'll answer the second question. I think there's a separate thing we could discuss on the very fascinating commonality between near-death experiences, psychedelic experiences, Vipassana meditation. And there seems to be a number of different doorways into the same state, but I'll put a pin in that and we can come back to that. Do you find people who are like more eager for personal growth or for a growth mindset after these experiences? One of the analogies I like the most, if you've ever tried to build a fire with kind of wet wood or wood that's just a little bit hard to work with, but oftentimes if you add a fire starter log, that can like just change everything. And that can just really help. Like once you just need one, and you, once you get that fire starter going, it brings the fire to life and then it sustains itself. And I think that's what these experiences can really do. And that oftentimes you have people come in. We just ran a retreat this past weekend and someone came in and he's just like really struggling in life. And then you could see the difference in him in so many ways, but even just in his posture, in his face before and after the experience, like this was someone who really had a whole new spark of life come as a result of this experience. And then it is common to look back and be like, man, that wasn't me. I wasn't being myself. I wasn't all these ways that I was behaving in the past. If only I felt this way, then I could have shown up differently. So I think that does happen. And sure, it is quite analogous to near-death experience. This is not a cheap thing. Like this is a pretty expensive affair right now. And so we don't have many people come. Most people who come are suffering. Most people who come are like struggling in some way. Most of them are psychedelically naive. They've never done psychedelics before. I've been surprised to see many people don't drink. They don't use cannabis. They don't really do anything, but they're really curious about this for reasons that have nothing to do with alcohol. You know, this isn't recreation. This is a healing tool. So yeah, there certainly is interest among the entrepreneurial community. I think that they probably already have some psychedelic experiences and they probably have more of a willingness to find your local underground guide or do it yourself. So we haven't worked with too many of them ourselves. So most people are suffering.
Interesting. Kind of sad to hear that, but it certainly makes sense. I also wanted to ask, who is this not for besides people that can't afford it?
Fortunately, psilocybin is quite a physiologically safe substance. And there are like pretty few things that it's like, it is just straight up unsafe to do this. One of them is if you're taking lithium, then there's a very, very high rate of having seizures if you mix lithium and psilocybin. For people who have severe cardiac issues, they should also likely steer clear. There is some interaction, you can see it just in the heart rate increase. There is some interaction between psilocybin and the heart, increases blood pressure as well temporarily. And then there's a whole slew of, okay, this is probably not a wise thing to do. It might be okay, but we would just really exercise caution. And those are folks who have a reason, have some predisposition to a psychotic disorder. So certainly if you yourself have schizophrenia, this is not a good idea. But even if you're 22 years old and you're one of your siblings or your parent has schizophrenia, probably not a great idea to do this. The link between the two is still being established. We're still figuring out what it is. But the leading ideas are that it can be a precipitating event. It can trigger the first psychotic break for someone who might have a predisposition. We haven't seen that. It's quite rare. And we take the screening process very seriously. But if you do have a reason to believe that you're predisposed to a psychotic disorder, this is, you should probably steer clear as well. And then I can pull up our whole screening criteria checklist. It's fairly nuanced and extensive. But yeah, generally speaking, we try to work with folks who are at least 25 and older than 30, because usually if you're going to develop a disorder like that, it usually onsets by the age of 25 or 30. No, but a reason to exercise caution is if you don't have a lot of support in your life. Like, these experiences can make things worse before they get better. Therapy can have a similar effect where it might bring up issues that you hadn't seen before, you hadn't looked at before, you hadn't addressed. And that can cause instability in someone's life. And that can cause symptoms to get worse before they get better. And so you want to make sure that you have folks, you have loved ones in your life you can talk to about this experience. You have a therapist that you can work with, someone that you can work through these issues. We provide support ourselves, but you know, we don't become someone's forever therapist. So we try to support people as much as we can and then hand them back off to whatever their support network was before. So it's important to have a support system and then generally have healthy expectations, where we like to make sure that people, like, this is part of a process for folks. People are not expecting it to be a panacea. They understand that this can be a very powerful tool, but it's likely not just going to solve all their problems overnight. Because you can do a lot of damage when someone comes in with sky high expectations and thinks, oh, this better do X, Y, and Z.
Yeah, definitely. As in, if you've got all your hopes on something working and it doesn't, it's sort of, you're suddenly left without anything at all. And yeah, I do find, as you're saying, like, therapy, it can sometimes be bad for people if they don't have so much support, or if you just dig up a bunch of past problems and then just have a reason to blame everything and just feel like they can't do anything about it. It's actually more disorientating than helpful. What about panic attacks? Because they do ask about that on the passenger entrance, is panic attacks, because that's obviously pretty scary to try and take any meaningful amount of hallucinogenics if you do have them.
I would say it's a yellow flag. We've had a number of folks come who do struggle with back issues, and this ends up being very helpful. I think there is an increased likelihood that someone who is prone to panic attacks will have quite an unpleasant experience. Again, nothing is for certain, but they might have quite an unpleasant experience. But it's equally important to distinguish that from whether or not they should do this. The recent client who had OCD, he had a very unpleasant experience, and he said it was totally life transformative. So just because we think someone might have a pretty unpleasant experience doesn't make me think that they shouldn't do this. What is really going to steer our opinion on whether or not we would work with someone is, do we have a strong conviction that this is going to be beneficial for their life after this experience? So yeah, panic attacks, not a hard exclusionary criteria. Is worth clarifying that this might be unpleasant and make sure that they come in eyes wide open, but not exclusionary.
What about borderline disorder? And is there much evidence of it helping? Because that's generally a thing that gets better with age. Like you said, like, you're talking about issues that appear before 30. Borderline's more something that appears and tends to recede as you get wrong. But I'd imagine it could be really helpful. But also, someone that sort of struggles with emotion regulation could also be actually worsening.
Yeah, and that's actually one of the criteria that I didn't get into and didn't mention is, right now we don't work with folks with borderline. And the general thinking is that it can make it worse. There's a high likelihood of making it worse. Like, it really can. And I think for the same reason that it can make folks bipolar, like, it can trigger kind of these manic episodes. So maybe it can. There's an interesting study being done at UCSF looking at using psilocybin-assisted therapy to treat bipolar type 2. So there is some, it's not BPD, but so I think it's too early to say for sure, but we do know, at least amongst the, like, anecdotally among the community and research community, is that it might, in working with folks with personality disorders like borderline, it's tricky, and we're still figuring out if it's safe. And so right now we're erring on the side of caution, and we generally do not work with folks with borderline.
And how about narcissism? Because you'd imagine if someone's just got a few narcissistic traits, it could be really helpful for them to have some ego disillusionment. But I wonder if someone's full narcissist, that it would just be like a weird, not helpful experience.
Maybe, I'm sure there's something interesting here, but we haven't had anyone who has narcissistic personality disorder be interested in coming through. I'm sure there's something there. Generally speaking, any sort of personality disorder is a yellow flag with these experiences. There's certainly risk if you have narcissistic personality disorder, both to be consuming it and to be a guide, where there's a lot of ego inflation that can happen during these experiences on both sides. And so you need to be very careful about the guy that you're working with. It's probably harder to steer someone who truly has narcissistic personality disorder through this.
Yeah, I'd be really interested because they do say that full-blown narcissism can't really be cured, whereas other things like borderline sort of is something that you can work on over time. So I do wonder if this was something that could cure narcissism, that could be amazing. But who knows?
Yeah.
You did mention being a guide, which was something I did actually want to ask questions about. What are the requirements for being a guide and what are the reasons people get into being a guide?
Question one, requirements. So there are the Oregon Health Authority's minimum requirements. You need to go through a specific training program, which is on average only about 6 months or so, which is if you compare that to your average amount of training that other mental health healthcare providers or really any sort of provider goes through, it's fairly minimal. And granted, Oregon's framework, separate question, is not medical, technically. We can go into that. So it's about a 6 month training program and then just your high school diploma. So the minimum requirements are quite low, which when I saw that, I think it's neat, but also scary, which is like, hey, it really matters who your guide is and you want to make sure that they're great. Now the onus is just on us. It's on other service center operators. It's on folks to say, hey, who are we going to hire? Who do we feel comfortable working with? And so we have a mix of folks on the team. Some are PhD clinical psychologists who have been trauma therapists for 20 years. Other folks don't have healthcare backgrounds, but just seem to be like really talented at this. And you know, what you want to see is someone who has a very calming, warm, caring presence, is very comfortable with the intensity of these, has a lot of experience. We work with guides who were working in the underground before this pretty extensively, are very careful not to push kind of dogmatic views on folks. Like there's a lot of strange spiritual beliefs that people implicitly or explicitly push on folks through their practice. And so you gotta make sure that someone is wise, is seasoned, doesn't push views on folks, is calm, is caring, is professional. It can be tough to like really suss this out. But yeah, our team is pretty diverse across training backgrounds.
My cousin, she works like a special needs school and she is so good at calming people down and just like accommodating whatever's going on with someone's feelings. Do you get many people from that sort of background?
I would say there's still a fair amount of mental health professionals who are interested. One of our guides, she did a lot of work as a domestic violence support person and doesn't have a mental health care provider credential, but she's just been around a lot of really hard situations before and does have a gift for diffusing, for calming. And, you know, I think we will find that there are certain professions, whether it's being a nurse or some of these other professions, that folks have a gift for really calming folks. And I think they make great guides.
Okay, cool. Back to more like to the side of what's going on in your brain and like the default mode network, like how does psilocybin affect it and create these better outcomes and different states of thinking?
There was actually a pretty interesting Nature paper published recently by Professor Goldolan. She said, hey, it looks like psilocybin opens the critical learning period. So, you know, the period in our lives where it does seem knowledge is absorbed more rapidly and the whole brain is just in a more plastic state, it seems like psilocybin can really reopen that. And so before that paper, the general thought is that it can increase neuroplasticity, which does seem to be true. And then this paper just furthered that hypothesis. However you look at it, it does seem like it makes the brain more amenable to change after these experiences. And that's why some of the habits were harder to change before that you could have changed before, but suddenly are easier after, or the beliefs that were just hard to change before are easier to change after. And there's a handful of kind of helpful analogies here, whether it's, hey, your brain, think of your brain as, and you've probably heard this one, your brain is, you know, a ski slope with certain tracks that have been ridden on. These are thought patterns that have been deeply ingrained into your brain, and that these experiences can act as a fresh sheet of snow to help form new neural pathways. Or the other one I like is you're a metal worker, you have a kiln, you heat up metal and you have this unique window after when the metal is still hot to reshape it and remold it into a shape that you want it to be. So yeah, choose your favorite analogy, choose your favorite piece of literature, but it does seem like after these experiences, the brain is in a more plastic state and the things that you want to change become a little bit easier to do so.
You just go through life, your brain just pings default answers to things and you're like, Why? There is infinite answers I could be coming up with. Why do I always go towards this thing?
You did say default mode network. So just to touch on that a little bit, as I'm sure you and many of your listeners are aware, the default mode network is the part of the brain that's active when you're not engaged in something. It's often where you're ruminating about the past, you're worrying about the future, you're just somewhere other than the present. And a lot of times people who have psychological issues, illnesses, have overactive default mode networks. And it seems like quieting down this part of the brain, and this is also where if the self lives somewhere, it seems like it could live in the default mode network. So this, because a lot of the self-referential processes seems to be engaged there. And there have been some pretty interesting studies that have compared the brains of seasoned meditators and those of folks who are on psilocybin. And it does seem like it does similar things. Both of them can quiet down the default mode network. That is super fascinating.
So is there much connection between the default mode network then and the ego? As you say, it can be like the self in many ways.
Yeah, I would say at this point, we're firmly in the category of, I think maybe, we can't say for sure, but yeah, it seems that way. Yeah, this seems to be a lot of, you know, overactive ego. What is it doing? It's thinking about self. It's thinking about the future. It's thinking about the past. It's worrying. It's ruminating. It's doing all sorts of things. All the classic things that it's wanting things. And it seems like that is a lot of activity is what goes on when you're not present, when you're not engaged in something. And that's what the default mode network is.
Do people find it easier to break into flow states afterwards?
I would say anecdotally at this point, we don't have enough research to say that. That'd be an interesting study if we could measure, hey, how much time were they spending in flow before and after an experience? I would hypothesize that yes, for that exact reason, that you're now more deeply immersed in the present. And that's exactly what flow is. I think the default mode network is probably almost entirely off. I'm sure not entirely, but nearly. And so, yeah, I would hypothesize that the answer is yes, although can't say for sure.
And backtracking to disorders and treating people, do you have many people with ADHD? Because I have ADHD and sometimes take drugs, but it's not my favorite. I did find actually therapy for it was super useful. Doing things like meditating, getting back into like my head a bit more is incredibly helpful, but also really hard to do if you just try and start meditating. Like I had no benefit from meditating until I went and did like the Vipassana retreat, really.
Wow.
Doing something like crazy next level was actually really helpful. And imagine also doing something like a retreat into psilocybin would have some similar benefits of realizing what my priorities are and being like, okay, I just can just ignore all this shit. But yeah, I don't know if you have any experience on that area.
I would say we're starting to have more folks who are say, hey, I have ADHD, can you help? And the truth is, I don't know. It's not a researched area yet. So at this point we can kind of, you know, hypothesize that it might, but yeah, we definitely can't say like that this is, we're very far from saying this is a treatment for ADHD.
I think it's one of those things like, instead of thinking it as a, can you cure ADHD? It's more, can you get the person to come to terms with their life and do something that interests them better? Because ADHD is not so much of a, can you get better at this thing? It's more, okay, you're good at lots of things. Go and do the things you're good at and enjoy them. Like I like geeking out on science. I like talking to people. I like creating. It's not that hard for me to run a podcast, but trying to have like a million calls a day and run a business was actually really stressful for me. And there might be ways I could still be involved in business if I'm working in a team where I'm allowed to be a bit weird and do odd stuff. But actually, if I have to 9-to-5 office laptop all day, it's not going to be within my strengths, even if I am technically good at all of the different tasks I have. If I was just doing one of them, but trying to like manage myself becomes chaos. Like I definitely had some breakthroughs actually on shrooms of what my problems were, even though I didn't even know I had ADHD back then, and went into a direction that was better for me. So yeah, I don't think you can solve people's ADHD, but you might actually give them some like life breakthroughs to do something better.
I mean, I'm curious about the, like, if you found that a silent meditation tree, I don't know if it was because of the intense amount of focus, but it does seem like that was addressing something to do with attention, something more than just value alignment and activity alignment. And I suspect that psilocybin could, anytime meditation helps something, I think there's a chance that psilocybin could help it too.
So there's one thing that I think you might somehow get a breakthrough, but in a different way. So one of the issues with a 10-day meditation retreat is the pain of the 1-hour meditations where you can't move at all. But one of the big learnings is to observe your pain and let go of it and be like, yeah, I think I'm going to have a broken leg and never walk again because it's so damn painful, and resist it and not focus on it and let it kind of melt away. And you just become really aware of your body sensations and all these different like things that are coming at you without reacting to them. And so then in life, when you have this feeling like this urge to be angry at something or this urge to check Facebook, whatever, you kind of notice the feeling before you react to it. You have a bit of a filter of, do I actually need to pay attention to this emotion and this like feeling of pain within me? Which I guess you don't have 10 days of pain and ignoring pain when you're doing psilocybin, but you might have some other angles at which you can ignore your stupid needs that don't need to be listened to. But yeah, I would really recommend a 10-day Vipassana, also a psilocybin retreat, and nearly die, having tried versions at least of all of them. They all have the different benefits.
Yeah. At the end, you know, there's like, not for everyone. Not everyone should do them. Have you listened to the retreat podcast? It's a little bit unclear what percent of people, and a lot of the same disclaimers that go to psychedelic experiences go to meditation retreats too. So, you know, the reality is like most people who do them will be fine. And there are some people that it really does mess up. So I mean, even something that sounds as innocuous as meditation can be dangerous to some. And that's, it's a super fascinating podcast if you're curious.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, I'll look into it. Because I definitely found some people find it difficult to be with their thoughts in like a horrible way. And it can be better for them to not be there. Each of the retreats I've done, there's usually been one or two people drop out. But on the first one, there was a guy that was just really unhappy with being told to let go of his anger. And he just fundamentally wanted to be angry about stuff. And then he was angry at them telling him to not be angry. And you're like, okay, bro, maybe not your thing. But I'm not sure he was necessarily having like a bad negative experience exactly in terms of like it ruining his life, but it wasn't for him. Have you noticed much in terms of cultural differences? Because certainly America in general is more individualistic and perhaps egoic compared to Asia, where they're more family orientated.
Hopefully this changes, but like right now, the overwhelming majority of people who are consuming psychedelics and interested in them are come from a pretty similar background. Like 85-90% are white and are American. That's an interesting idea. And I would expect some differences there. And I'm curious to see as time goes on, do we find some cultures are drawn to this and some cultures get a lot out of this? And so I'm not sure, but just right now we've had a very homogenous group going through clinical trials and engaging in these in general.
That's interesting. Sad that we didn't have lots of time to actually ask more questions on why and the different things that you've gone through getting to where you are, because that would actually be quite interesting. So good luck to you. It sounds like you're doing some really cool stuff. I can see it helping lots of people and growing. It's nice to see people actually pushing it.
Yeah, thanks, Jeff. Appreciate you having me on.
You're welcome. Well, I hope you enjoyed the conversation as much as I did. As you may have guessed, I have been fascinated with the development of psychedelic treatments and their adoption for a long time, and it's great to see the progress it's making. And of course, if it does intrigue you, his company Odyssey run retreats in Oregon and also personal experiences for people. So if you're in America and you wanted to look into it, it's totally worth having a look. They will help you from the initial screening, preparation, on-site facilitation, and as we spoke about, the integration of the experience afterwards. All of those details will be in the show notes. Right. I said earlier that we did have a long conversation about books and his top recommended lists for people considering retreats. Firstly, just a reminder of the books that we'd already mentioned from his list were Michael Pollan's How to Change Your Mind, which discusses all the leading science on using psychedelics for treatment of different mental health problems and having breakthroughs. He also highly recommended Michael Singer's The Untethered Soul, whose chapters are described as different mirrors with which to look at oneself, which sounds great and I'm looking forward to. He also spoke about the Retreat podcast by the Financial Times, which is an investigative journalism podcast into the dangers of meditation retreats, and it's a fascinating listen. And it perhaps comes across a little opinionated, like all they wanted to find out was everything bad about them, but it's still interesting to find out that there are some problems, for sure. And then the ones that you haven't heard about were The Courage to be Disliked by Ichiro Kishimi, Stumbling on Happiness by Daniel Gilbert, When Awareness Becomes Natural by Sayadaw Tejinaya, Siddhartha by Hermann Hesse, which is one of my absolute favorite books, And he gave a spare bonus fantasy fiction novel recommendation, which was The Name of the Wind by Patrick Rothfuss, and I can also confirm is a brilliant book. And if you did find anything interesting in the episode, or if you have a friend that is keen to learn more about psychedelic retreats, then do share away, as it is how the show grows, and that's very appreciated. If you are overwhelmed by a sense of oceanic boundlessness after listening to this, then feel free to fill our review section with some honest opinions of how incredibly brilliant the podcast is. That would be quite fine if that's what you chose to do. And I am actually really intrigued to hear what you thought about the episode and if you are keen to hear more about psychedelics or anything else. Stick a reply in a comment or email me, and that would be a big help. Remember, life is short, and it is too short to keep skiing down the same worn routes of your mind. So shake it up a bit and do something different today. Doesn't have to be psychedelics, just anything that's different. And of course, don't take things too seriously. Be kind to yourself, and whilst you're at it, be kind to someone else too.